From Storyflow Science, Science the Week's Top 10 June 5th. The Storyflow Daily Brief for June 5th. Here are this week's top 10 science stories. We are running a curated backlog catch-up, so today's science show has the same shape as the rest of the daily lineup. First, from End Bird Shooting. White-tailed eagle disappears in North York Moors. A juvenile white-tailed eagle, designated G834, was born in the wild in Dorset in August 2025, the first such fledgling in the county for more than two centuries. The bird satellite tag recorded a wide spring migration across England, ending on the western edge of the North York Moors on 30 April 2026. Overnight into 1 May, the tag stopped transmitting and has remained silent, prompting North Yorkshire Police to launch a suspicious death investigation. The police appeal asks anyone with information to contact them, citing a reference number. Wildlife crime analysts consider the loss unlikely to be a technical failure, given the robustness of modern satellite tags. The region has a documented history of illegal raptor persecution, with numerous confirmed shootings, poisonings and trap incidents involving buzzards, red kites, peregrines and goshawks over the past decade. Recent years have seen a string of shot buzzards on moorland, and the National Park Authority has previously highlighted raptor killings within its boundaries. Conservation groups behind the Reed Introduction Project expressed shock and sadness, noting strong public support for the return of the species and the economic benefits of eagle tourism seen elsewhere in the UK. They argue that the current national park framework offers little real protection, as most of the moorland is privately owned and the authority lacks enforcement powers. The article calls for stronger legislation, such as vicarious liability for landowners, mandatory camera monitoring of areas where tagged birds disappear, and genuine statutory powers for park bodies. The disappearance of G834 adds to a long list of raptor losses in the area and underscores a cultural conflict between traditional game shooting interests and wildlife protection. Advocates urge the public's anger to be turned into political pressure to change entrenched attitudes and to ensure that illegal killing of birds of prey, which has been prohibited for decades, finally ceases. Second, from Chad's Weather Blog, June 3, 6 a.m. weather forecast. Local sponsors have helped expand weather stations across the region, allowing the new app to go live with enhanced radar and graphic capabilities. The community-backed effort aims to keep residents informed and safe with accurate daily forecasts. Yesterday's temperatures ranged from a cool 49 degrees F low at Lake Village and Kentland to a high of 83 degrees F near Fowler and Pine Village. Most airports recorded highs between 77 and 83 degrees F, with the coolest highs at Crawfordsville and surrounding sites. Humidity dropped to a rare early June low of about 15%, mirroring conditions seen in 2023. Today the sun is intense, pushing UV levels into the high-risk zone, while pollen counts sit at medium high. Air quality has improved to good after a brief moderate spell, though it's expected to drift back toward moderate later in the week. Winds are lighter than yesterday, and the dry air will keep the heat feeling less oppressive. Looking ahead, the late spring heat will climb, turning the early morning coolness into a muggy feel as temperatures rise. Expect a warm, dry Wednesday and Thursday, with Friday staying drier until evening. Low humidity and reduced wind will make the heat more tolerable, but the overall trend points toward the highest temperatures of the season so far. Third, from Chad's Weather Blog. Local weather history, June 2 and 3, 1990 tornado outbreak and high wind episode in our forecast area. The June 2-3, 1990 severe weather event began with a high-risk tornado outbreak that stretched from Minnesota on June 1 to Arkansas, Kentucky and southwestern Ontario by early June 3. 6-5 tornadoes touched down, 37 of them in Indiana, the state's highest single outbreak count since 1950. The most lethal was an F4 that ripped through Petersburg, Indiana, killing 6 people and injuring 60. Another long-track F4 moved from southeastern Illinois into southwest Indiana, causing 1 death and 11 injuries, while a separate F4 in southeastern Indiana injured 37. In the forecast area, 13 tornadoes were confirmed, a record that stood until the 2013 November outbreak. The tornadoes in the local zone were generally weaker than those farther south, reflecting high Cape and helicity in southern Indiana and Illinois. Straight-line winds added to the destruction, with gusts up to 80 mph reported across a swath of counties. Fallen trees and downed power lines were common in Newton, Jasper, Pulaski, Fulton, Miami, Cass, White, Warren, Howard, Benton, and Carroll counties. Notable wind damage included a machine shed near Brookston, roof and garage damage in Fulton County, and an injured person in a trailer in Miami County. A brief F2 in Montgomery County tracked 12 miles, injuring 12 people. The day after the tornadoes, a non-thunderstorm high wind event brought cooler air, blowing dust, and gusts again reaching 80 mph. Visibility dropped to near zero in central and northern Illinois and parts of the forecast area. Kokomo recorded 368 mph gusts within a three-hour span on Sunday afternoon. This pattern of strong post-outbreak winds mirrors other historic events, such as the 1985 Michigan-Ohio-Ontario tornado outbreak and the 2013 November outbreak, where gradient winds of 50-65 mph followed the tornadoes. Tragically, the high winds claimed three children's lives in West Lafayette and Mulberry when falling trees struck them in a park. Overall, the June 1990 outbreak left a lasting impression on the region. Extensive tornado damage, widespread straight-line wind destruction, and a subsequent dust-laden windstorm that underscored the power of the underlying low-pressure system. Fourth, from the Weekly Anthropocene. The Weekly Anthropocene, June 3, 2026. A record number of dams were removed in the United States and Europe in 2025, with 100 dams taken out in the US and 602 river barriers removed in Europe. This has helped to restore river flow, reduce flood risks, and improve biodiversity. In the US, over 4,893 miles of river flow were reconnected, while in Europe, 2,324 miles of rivers were reconnected. In other conservation news, a breeding colony of king penguins has been established in Chile, thanks to the efforts of a local landowner who protected the area from human disturbance and invasive species. The colony has grown to nearly 200 penguins, with a record 23 surviving chicks in 2025. India is making significant strides in clean energy, with solar capacity increasing by 40% per year. The country is building large solar farms, including the world's largest solar park, which will cover 280 square miles and produce 30 gigawatts of energy. In Africa, the reintroduction of endangered tortoises has helped to reverse desertification in Senegal. The tortoises' burrows have allowed rainwater to be stored in the soil, leading to the growth of green vegetation. In Europe, the reintroduction of European bison has helped to create a more complex and ecologically rich landscape in the UK. Several other conservation efforts are underway around the world, including the establishment of a Rights of Nature Charter for the River Wye in the UK, the reintroduction of beavers in West London, and the creation of a massive marine protected area in Papua New Guinea. In Japan, the use of solar-powered robots to scare away bears is becoming increasingly popular following a spike in bear incursions into farms and towns. The robots emit loud noises and sudden movements to keep bears away from crops and human settlements. Overall, these efforts demonstrate a growing trend towards conservation and sustainability, with many countries and communities working to restore ecosystems, protect wildlife, and promote clean energy. Fifth, from Psychiatry at the Margins. Mixed bag #26, Darby Saxbe on the science of fatherhood. Darby Saxbe, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at USC, has distilled 15 years of research on new fathers into her popular science book Dad Brain. The work follows first-time parents from pregnancy through the first year after birth, blending lab data with interviews to show how fatherhood reshapes men's neurobiology, health, relationships, and sense of self. Saxbe argues that becoming a dad triggers both biological and cultural changes, and that understanding these shifts can inform workplace policies and broader social expectations. A central theme of the book is the idea of facultative adaptation behaviors that are not hardwired but depend on environmental cues. Saxbe likens this to species that switch from four-legged locomotion to bipedalism when circumstances demand it, suggesting that human fathers can add bonus arms of care when children need extra support. This flexibility helps explain why some men become primary caregivers while others remain largely uninvolved, and why societies vary in what they deem a good father, oscillating among provider, protector, and hands-on caregiver roles. Saxbe credits anthropologist Sarah Hrdy for shaping her thinking about alloparenting, the cooperative breeding system in which multiple caregivers help raise offspring. Hrdy's work highlighted how humans rely on a social brain to monitor and trust others who can pitch in. and her career as a pioneering woman in a male-dominated field serves as a model for integrating rigorous research with accessible writing. The book also draws on a pivotal review by Jim Rilling, which maps the hormonal and neural circuits oxytocin, vasopressin, prolactin, testosterone, and related brain regions that underlie sensitive parenting. Sachs uses this framework to guide her own longitudinal study design. Finally, she points to prairie vole research, noting how these monogamous rodents display shared parental care, neural synchrony, and oxytocin-driven prosocial behavior, offering a useful animal model for understanding human fatherhood. Sixth, from the spiritual psychiatrist. The Grail was never a cup, it was your body. The article claims humanity was originally organized into 12 celestial tribes, each linked to a specific frequency and a corresponding stargate, a metaphysical portal that controls Earth's energy lines. Whoever controls these stargates can manipulate global events, media, and even DNA, because DNA is described as a scalar antenna that responds to sound, light, and symbols. Wars, media manipulation, and societal control are said to be battles over these invisible pieces of real estate. At the top of this system sits a figure called the Magi Grail King, not a monarch but a human who has activated enough of the 12-strand template to channel a planetary current through their body. The article equates the Grail with the human body itself, a vessel for an eternal life current. It identifies Jesus Jeshua 12 as a past Grail King who worked with a female counterpart, Sophia, to keep the planetary grid aligned. The Grail, therefore, is never a cup but a biological function meant to restore Earth's ascension pathway. According to the narrative, non-Christic groups labeled Anunnaki, Draconian, and Leviathan lineages deliberately fragmented the tribes through genetic interference, cataclysms, and institutional erasure. The collapse of Atlantis around 10,500 BC broke the grid, and later Essene raids in 23 AD scattered the remaining leaders and destroyed records. The original knowledge was supposedly absorbed into religion, stripped of its mechanics, and replaced by external authority systems to keep people unaware of their true nature. The author argues that we are now in an inner Christos realignment cycle, a window when planetary shields are reactivating and dormant tribal codes embedded in DNA are being called to remembrance. The 12 tribes are said to still exist in a dormant state within what scientists once called junk DNA. Breathwork and other practices can quiet the mind, allowing the soul to recall ancient timelines and activate these cellular memories. Finally, the piece urges readers to recognize that the frequency that led them to the article is a sign their template has responded. By practicing slow, full breathing, stabilizing the nervous system, and engaging in 12-strand activation, individuals are said to be completing a mission begun hundreds of thousands of years ago. The map to this awakening, the article claims, has never been lost. It resides in the body, and the window to fully read it is open now. Seventh, from Holistic Farming. Can you help me build what comes next? A few quick questions, no typing required. 3-4 mins? The author has spent a year creating detailed plant monographs that explore each species from soil to focal, but now wants to shift toward helping readers form a personal relationship with plants. Instead of long essays or identification quizzes, the new format will be short, warm, and practical, delivered daily or weekly as a simple getting-to-know-a-friend experience. To shape this next phase, the author is running a 30-question poll that takes about 4 minutes and requires only clicks, no typing. The first 20 questions gauge how people prefer to learn plant wisdom, while an optional extra 10 questions dive deeper into preferences. Completion of the poll earns participants a stinging nettle infographic and access to a full deep dive profile on Scotch broom. Scotch broom, a widely disliked invasive species, is offered as a case study to illustrate the value of understanding a plant's ecology, behavior, and impact rather than simply labeling it as a problem. The deep dive will be free for a limited time before moving to a paid library, encouraging readers to engage with the material now. The overarching goal is to build a plant relationship ecosystem that is practical for gardeners and farmers, accessible to beginners, and deep enough to honor ecological complexity. By listening to how plants talk through these quick clicks, the creator hopes to foster more informed, respectful decisions about land and vegetation. 8th, from Ecomodernist, caught between Hormuz and a Chinese hard place. Japan's energy system is built on scarce domestic resources, no fossil fuels, limited sunlight, and a rugged coastline ill-suited for offshore wind. After the 2011 Fukushima disaster, the country shut down all its nuclear plants, which had supplied more than a quarter of its electricity, and now relies on imported oil, coal, and gas for almost 80% of its energy. Much of that oil must pass through the Strait of Hormuz, and rising LNG prices are adding to the economic strain. Strategic petroleum reserves are being drawn down, but they are finite, leaving Japan vulnerable to geopolitical shocks. Renewable options are constrained by geography and grid incompatibilities. Solar and wind can only modestly offset demand, and expanding them would shift the supply chain dependence from Gulf hydrocarbons to Chinese green technology manufacturers, a security concern given China's status as Japan's chief rival. The government's all-of-the-above strategy now imports oil from the Gulf, coal from Australia, gas from multiple regions, and renewable equipment from China, a mix that undercuts its net-zero pledges. In response to the current crisis, Tokyo has issued emergency waivers to run dirtier subcritical coal plants at higher capacity, conserving costly LNG for peak loads. At the same time, nuclear reactors are being brought back online, now providing just over 9% of electricity, far short of the pre-Fukushima 30% level. Plans to restart most legacy reactors and finish stalled new builds suggest a pivot toward nuclear as the most viable route to reduce import reliance while preserving climate goals. Japan remains the world's most energy-efficient and electrified economy, with solar now supplying about a tenth of its power despite unfavorable conditions. Yet its domestic solar and battery industries have largely been ceded to China. Given its deep technical expertise, indigenized nuclear fuel cycle, and existing capacity to fabricate large reactor components, the most realistic path forward appears to be a renewed nuclear program balancing energy security, economic imperatives, and the still fragile net zero trajectory. Ninth, from urban career boost by all things urban. Learning, connecting, and taking action in urbanism. This edition brings together a range of opportunities that reflect the different ways urbanists continue to learn, connect, and grow throughout their careers. Alongside new study pathways and learning opportunities are international events, community initiatives, and conversations focused on some of the key challenges shaping cities today. The edition also includes fellowships, research opportunities, and roles connected to mobility, climate, housing, design, communications, and urban innovation. A common thread running through many of these opportunities is the connection between knowledge and practice. Whether through learning, collaboration, research, or professional experience, they offer different ways of engaging with the ideas, people, and institutions shaping urban futures. The opportunities featured here span multiple stages of an urban career. Some are aimed at those taking their first steps in the field, while others are designed for experienced professionals looking to take on new challenges or explore new directions. Urbanism has always been shaped through exchange between disciplines, between sectors, and between people working in different places and contexts. Many of the opportunities featured in this edition create exactly those kinds of connections, opening new spaces for collaboration, learning, and professional growth. As always, we hope this newsletter helps you discover your next opportunity, meet new collaborators, and stay connected to the people and ideas shaping urban futures. Let's get into it. Want to collaborate, partner, or bring something to this community of 100,000 plus urban professionals worldwide? Just reply to this email. If you've been thinking about moving into urban planning or going further in it without pausing your career, this one is worth a look. The Folio Online Part-Time MSc Urban Planning at the University of the Built Environment is a UK-accredited master's designed for working professionals, whether you are entering the field or building deeper expertise within it. The curriculum spans planning theory, legislation, sustainability, and the social, economic, and environmental forces shaping cities, with a clear focus on the skills the profession actually needs now. Why we're sharing it: UK-accredited postgraduate degree, RICS-accredited and RTPI-recognised, covers current and emerging topics including AI, data, and digital planning. Flexible, part-time format that fits around full-time work opens career paths in both public and private sectors. 10 modules plus in. Independent research project Folio Online. 2 years part-time applications open for September 2026. Intake deadline 10 August 2026. Considering applying? They are also hosting an upcoming interactive webinar for anyone interested in learning more about the program online study experience, and the support available for students. Join the program team for a free interactive webinar and learn more about the course, online study experience, student support, and admissions process. There will also be a live Q&A at the end of the webinar. Webinar 6 July 2026, 12:00 PM UK time. Looking for something with a stronger focus on climate action and urban sustainability? This next program explores how cities can become more resilient, innovative, and prepared for the challenges of the future. Sorbonne University Abu Dhabi is hosting a free webinar on June 8 for its Master in Urban Planning and Development Urban Innovation and Sustainability Urbis, and it is a genuine chance to look inside the program before you apply. In 1 hour you will get a clear picture of the courses, structure, admission requirements, merit-based scholarships, preferential rates, and the application deadline. There is also a live Q&A, so you can put your questions straight to the head of program and the admission team. The session is led by Dr. Simon Saif, architect, urban planner, and geographer. It is one we genuinely recommend, taught fully in English with an international cohort, awarding a Sorbonne diploma with a straightforward UAE visa process, and built around sustainability and climate resilience, studied on the ground in a region facing extreme heat. June 8, 2026, 4:00-5:00 PM UAE time. Online universities, education providers, companies, NGO, and organizations working in urbanism want to reach 100,000 plus urban professionals globally. We support visibility campaigns, targeted newsletters, webinars, events, and long-term awareness building tailored to your goals. Reach out at email redacted. A 5-day celebration of architecture, design, sustainability, and community building in the heart of Brussels. Location, Brussels, Belgium. 10th, from Roberto Berioni, Medico. Un altro assassino messo nel mirino, la forma più aggressiva del cancro del colon, negli ultimi anni la ricerca oncologica ha registrato progressi senza precedenti, ed un nuovo studio conferma che anche la forma più aggressiva del cancro del colon possono ora essere trattate con risultati sorprendenti. Il lavoro connotto su più di 1000 pazienti con tumori avanzati ha valutato l'efficacia di una combinazione di immunotherapia a checkpoint e terapia mirata contro mutazioni specifiche del DNA tumorale. I ricercatori hanno suddiviso i partecipanti in due gruppi, uno ha ricevuto la terapia standard, e l'altro la nuova combinazione. I dati mostrano che la sopravvivenza globale a 3 anni e grave passata dal 35% al 68% nel gruppo trattato con la combinazione con una risposta completa del tumore in quasi il 30% dei casi. Inoltre, la percentuale di recidive e grave diminuita drasticamente, e gli effetti collaterali sono risultati gestibili grazie a protocolli di monitoraggio più intensi. Questi risultati superano di gran lunga la aspettativa di pochi anni fa, quando tali cure erano considerate quasi miracolose. Il successo è grave attribuito alla capacità dell'immunoterapia di riattivare il sistema immunitario contro le cellule tumorali, mentre la terapia mirata blocca i percorsi di crescita specifici del mutazione più pericolose. La sinergia tra i due approcci ha permesso di ridurre la resistenza al trattamento, un problema comune nel form più aggressive di cancro del colon. I ricercatori hanno anche identificato biomarcatori che predicono meglio la risposta, aprendo la strada a trattamenti personalizzati. Gli autori sottolineano che, sebbene i risultati siano promettenti, è grave necessario proseguire con studi più ampi e a lungo termine per confermare la durata dei benefici e ottimizzare i regimi di dosaggio. Nel frattempo, la scoperta rappresenta una svolta significativa per i pazienti con tumori avanzati, offrendo speranza di una vita più lunga e di una migliore qualità di vita. La medicina oncologica sta davvero entrando in un'epoca d'oro, dove anche i nemici più temibili possono essere affrontati con strategie sempre più efficaci. That's the Science Backlog Edit.